You're listening to Clack Radio, produced by members of the Clack, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence of Montreal. On June 26th and 27th, as the G8, the Group of Eight, met in Kananaskis, Alberta, thousands of people took to the streets to oppose and denounce the meetings, which took place in the secluded resort. The mobilization which took place in Ottawa, called Take the Capital, drew thousands from throughout the Northeast region. The Take the Capital campaign sought to build local and regional resistance stronger and make ties with struggles affecting our communities here at home. As part of this resistance in Ottawa, a squat action took place on June 26th, where activists reappropriated an abandoned building in downtown Ottawa to highlight and fight against the housing crisis, which is ever apparent in Ottawa, where vacancy rates have dipped below 1%, as across Canada. We spoke to Dan Sawyer about the squat action and where it stands today and the imminent threat of police attack.
This action started, in some ways, it was started being planned about 9 months ago. This building that the squat happened in is sort of a well-known building in the downtown area, and people have always been eyeing it for an action. But about 2 months ago, it really went into sort of high gear in terms of when we did it and how we would do it. And it seemed to make sense to do it during Take the Capital, because the groups involved, particularly Anti-Capitalist Community Action and OCAT, the Ottawa Coalition Against the Tories, part of the focus of these groups is like making our resistance to global systems of oppression, like capitalism and imperialism, as local as possible. And so, you know, we focus on things like police brutality, we focus on things like the housing crisis, but we do it in the context of, like, global financial systems as sort of the root of local problems. And so we wanted to confront the housing crisis locally, and over a period of weeks, and discussion, we determined that, like, this housing action was the way to go. And people came on board very quickly to support that action. And we wanted to do it during Take the Capital because that was the essence of the Take the Capital campaign, was like localizing and regionalizing our resistance to global systems like capitalism and imperialism. And where we're at now is actually this very interesting time that we're doing this interview. We're coming up on the seventh day of the seven-year squat. We're looking at probably a fairly imminent police shutdown based on events that happened today.
And how has communities around the squat and people in Ottawa generally responded to the opening of the squat and the continuing of the squat and people living there? And
well, the squat, just to give people that don't know, it's located in sort of the center town, downtown area of Ottawa, and it's right directly across the street from the Public Service Alliance of Canada, which is a big sort of relatively progressive union in some ways. It's located just to the left, separated by like a 5-foot alley from a 5-story apartment building. It's just off like sort of a main drag with a lot of bars and small restaurants and small businesses and lots of residential area around it. And the community support has been outstanding. It's been absolutely amazing. Right from the first day, from the minute the action started, actually, we had union activists from PSAC across the street coming over, doing scouting for us, handing out leaflets, acting as a buffer between us and the police, which showed up very quickly. We had, on the first day when we were under a state of siege and the police had us surrounded, neighbors from across the alley beside us were opening their windows and handing us blankets and water. They were hooking up extension cords and running them out of their outlets into our place so we could run lamps at night, running hoses from their kitchen taps into our place so we could have running water. The level of community support has been amazing. And that also translates into real, like, links of solidarity that are being built between anti-poverty groups in town, anti-capitalist groups in town, different groups that are confronting a lot of similar and very linked things but traditionally haven't worked together, are really coming together in powerful ways to support this project.
And what was the context under which the housing action was organized? What kind of housing crisis are people facing in Ottawa? Could you give some of the bare bones of that?
Sure, yeah. It's a pretty fucked up situation in Ottawa. We called it the seven-year squat because in Ottawa, 15,000 families wait a minimum of 7 years to get into social housing in Ottawa. That's 15,000 families that are either living in the shelter system, couch surfing for extended periods of time, are marginally housed, are living on the street, or are living in dangerous or unsafe conditions. That's 15,000 families waiting a minimum of 7 years to get into social housing. And this building that we picked to do the action in has actually been abandoned for just over 7 years. There's also thousands of people that are sleeping in the shelter systems every night. thousands of people on, you know, on the street. We also have, you know, things like CFB Rockcliffe, which is an abandoned Army Forces base that has a neighborhood of 131 homes on it, which are totally livable and, in fact, had been used by a number of people for the last 2 years. But those people are now being evicted because the Department of National Defense wants to sell the land. They have, the people that are buying it have no intention of using it. They just want to own it and hold it for future use. So these houses, this whole neighborhood of livable homes, 131 are being bulldozed, and people are being evicted, like in the midst of a housing crisis. We have a 0.02 vacancy rate, 0.02% vacancy rate in Ottawa, and a 0.03% office space vacancy rate. And what we always find, of course, is that office space always wins out, right? There seems to be new office towers going up all the time in the midst of residential neighborhoods, and no social housing is going up. So Ottawa is like in the grip of a really major housing crisis. The city and the provincial governments are doing absolutely nothing to deal with it.
As the squad is on the front line of that struggle for housing, of that struggle against, you know, that continued gentrification, there is the imminent threat of the police closing it down and shutting it up and shutting it down. And you're facing that today. So could you give us a picture of what it looks like at the squat right now and how people are preparing?
Sure. What it looks like right now is that people are really angry. People are really, really angry at the police in the city right now for not engaging in good faith negotiations with us. We went into meetings with the city today at noon to talk about if there was at all possible a sort of negotiated settlement on this. Like, we had certain demands and they had certain things that they wanted. But essentially what happened was they were not good faith negotiations on the part of the city. Things that we were promised did not materialize. They showed tremendous disrespect for the way we organize and for our principles. So people are really angry right now, and they're committed to defending this building as long as possible, because people have spent the last 7 days devoting, you know, tremendous amounts of time, full days, doing renovation work, painting, scraping, replastering, repairs, renovations. It's been absolutely incredible the amount of time and energy that people have spent into making this building a livable, usable space, and people are going to really defend that. They're not going to give it up easily, particularly when the city and the police are so disrespectful to how we organize. And also, like tonight, there's probably going to be about 200 people sleeping in the street outside the building because we've put the call out. We've put the call out that people need to come and support the squat, and people are arriving in droves we're going to have a big camp out tonight out in front of the squat. And we're going to refuse to let the police get within any of the block of the building for as long as possible.
As part of the resistance, which took place in Ottawa on June 26th and 27th against the G8, during Take the Capitol, people converged on June 27th for No One is Illegal, a mass protest to highlight and denounce the realities facing many immigrant and refugee communities in Canada. As Kananaskis marked the signing of the Safe Third Country Agreement, which fundamentally limits chances for refugee and immigrants to enter Canada, there is a strong and growing movement to fight for the rights and lives of those facing the realities of Canada's racist immigration laws. This growing movement took to the streets in Ottawa on June 27th under the banner of No One is Illegal. We talked to Stephanie from OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, about their immigration casework, about the No One is Illegal actions in Ottawa, and the growing movement around the world against borders.
The majority of cases that we work with are people who have been deemed, quote, illegal by the state. That is to say that they have no status. And that either means that they have overstayed a visitor's visa and are currently looking for a means by which to legitimize their status as a Canadian citizen, or they've applied as a refugee and been denied refugee status. And this creating of an illegal status for people who are actually living, you know, within nations, contributing to society, raising families, et cetera, et cetera, is you know, an incredible misnomer, and it creates this massive black hole for people where they, while although they contribute to the economy and have children that are Canadian citizens or what have you, they themselves have no access to, say, for instance, social assistance or health care or student loans, you know, to education in general. There's a whole, like, part of what the country is supposed to offer that people who are illegal don't have access to, and not only that, more seriously, living the life of an illegal means constantly being living on the edge and waiting for a time where you know, almost inevitably will be removed from the country or deported. And the approval rates for all the different claims processes in Canada, which is seen as a generous country, are incredibly low. Like, the percentages of approval rates are very, very low. So, sorry, this is taking me a long time to answer, but I guess for us, no person is illegal is sort of a very straightforward refusal to accept that people should have to live in this this illegitimate, what often becomes criminalized state within the borders of nations, but more broadly, no person is illegal or no one is illegal is quite a powerful movement that is very much more established in other parts of the world, I would say. Like, I don't have in-depth understanding or knowledge of the European No Borders movement, for instance, but in a part of the world such as that, where countries are crammed so much closer together, and travel across borders is something that happens with relative ease in terms of time and distance and that sort of thing, there's a much more established resistance movement to racist immigration law and policies that prevent people from particular nations and of particular economic standing from accessing the things that they're entitled to access.
So when you speak about racist immigration laws, what specifically does that mean in the context of the Canadian government and Immigration Canada?
Oh, well, it would take me like 3 days to explain everything that means. I guess that I can talk about sort of current changes, because in this heightened climate of fear and paranoia, there are a number of new laws and, yeah, new laws that are coming into effect in Canada. Among those, a new, what's sort of sneeringly titled the Immigrant and Refugee Protection Act for the first time. So one of, just as an example, I mean, there are countless, but just as an example, people who become permanent residents in Canada now will be required to carry on their person at all times a plastic identification card. And there's a real trend towards fingerprinting and sort of very carefully documenting people that travel across the borders. And these cards, the permanent resident cards, are, you know, do have sort of very eerie shadows of apartheid regimes, like very obvious racist regimes that have existed in other parts of the world. I mean, I know that it happens already. We encounter people who are at home in their apartments and have immigration officials come to their door, and if there are non-white people in the room, everyone is asked for their identification, not just the person that the enforcement officials are seeking. But I don't know, in terms of racist immigration law and practice, if you look at the demographic of who comes into Canada in largest numbers versus who is removed from Canada in largest numbers, you start to very obviously see that there are decisions being made along racial and economic lines.
And one of the points of the Kananaskis meeting, the G8 leaders as they met in Alberta, was the Safe Third Country Agreement. This is something that's been in the news recently. Could you break that down and what it means for asylum seekers here in Canada?
Yeah, it's a very typical, of course, and very disturbing that it's only been in the news of late. This is an agreement that is going to shake the foundations of the way that a significant number of refugees move into or have been able to move into Canada in the past. And this is an agreement that, you know, wasn't publicly discussed at all. Basically, what the Safe Third Country Agreement means, and it is now reality, is that refugee claimants, asylum seekers, people that are seeking refuge, can no longer bounce through, as they say, bounce through the United States into Canada. And that's something that a lot of people have to do. First of all, because it's not always easy to get a direct flight into Canada if you're coming from somewhere that's quite far away. Secondly, if you're traveling overland, say, for people who are coming up from the southern part of the Americas and the Caribbean and so on, traveling overland, it isn't always possible to come directly into Canada. So there's something like 40% of refugee claimants in Canada that stop over in the U.S. first. But what's important is why people do that. Why are people heading for Canada, and why aren't they just making their claims in the United States? And why is this such a big deal? And the reasons that are so alarming are that, first of all, this so-called safe third country that is the United States gives incredible power to individual immigration and naturalization service. Those are the immigration officers. It gives individual officers immense power. So if you're an asylum seeker and you come into the United States and you make an initial claim at a point of entry, you know, whatever, a city, a port, or whatever, your claim is heard by one person. That person has the power on the spot to decide whether or not your claim is credible, and based on that can make a decision whether or not to remove you. You are in this process not entitled to access to a lawyer. You're not entitled to translation. You can't call any family members, nothing. So this one person has this immense amount of power to, you know, stop the process right there at the beginning, and that's something that doesn't happen in Canada. You do. Everyone has a right to make a claim and have it heard through a more thorough process than that. The other thing, this so-called safe third country that is the United States, is much less likely to recognize gender-based persecution as a reason for making, or a valid reason to make, a refugee claim. So if you're a woman fleeing abuse or patriarchal society, or fleeing female genital mutilation, the United States is a far less, your chances for being approved for refugee status are much higher in the in Canada than in the United States. Another thing is that the U.S. practices much more immediate detention, whereas in Canada you're able to come in, make a claim, and then sort of sort yourself out, get your feet, you know, on the ground, and stabilize your family. And in the United States, they have really shocking numbers of minors that are detained, and people are sort of much more readily put into immigration detention than they are in Canada. And also, the United States doesn't recognize this. Its international practice is called non-refoulement, which means if you're being returned to a country where you may face torture, the United States doesn't consider that grounds to not deport you, whereas Canada is much more likely to recognize that if you're being returned to a country where you may face torture, you know, things, other options should be considered, and, you know, that your claim should be viewed with seriousness and so on and so forth. So, yes, this safe third country that is now a done deal is going to cause great, you know, very serious hardship to a significant number of people who would have ordinarily made their claims in Canada. Because for all the reasons that I could give you that, you know, about how Canadian law is discriminatory and you know, biased and cruel, it is still, Canada is still an easier place to make a refugee claim or to seek asylum than the U.S. And now the borders are being sealed shut.
Now, prior to the signing of the Safe Third Country Agreement, OCAP Immigration has been involved in many cases of direct action casework. And through that, I'm sure there's many stories of hardship and resistance, both that you have seen in people's lives. Could you explain a little bit, or maybe give a couple pieces of reality for people to understand the types of situations which immigrants and refugees were facing already before the signing of this agreement, and will only be, you know, furtherly, you know, implemented after.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that's so infuriating about Canadian immigration policy is that Immigration Canada puts on a face of benignness and welcome and you know, open arms, and touts this principle of family reunification, or it's all over their propaganda. It's all over, you know, everything that they put out, that they are sort of, they firmly believe in the reunification of families, and almost every single situation that OCAP deals with, you know, the reality flies directly, you know, in the face of that. I mean, sponsorship processes take so long that we've worked with someone who came to Canada from Afghanistan and claimed refugee status, and had to leave his family in Afghanistan behind, was, you know, had to endure this years and years of waiting to actually get to a point where he had status and then could begin the sponsorship process for his family. And in the interim, his family found it incredibly difficult to believe that, you know, they knew that he was in Canada, they knew that he had made it to safety, and this was, you know, supposed to be a way for all of them to secure themselves, and they couldn't understand from such a great distance what was taking so long, and were convinced that, you know, he had abandoned them and, you know, was beginning a new life for himself in Canada, and he was pressured so heavily by and had, you know, all this incredible pain to deal with on the part of his family that he couldn't tolerate the weight and returned to Afghanistan and was never heard from again. You know, and you know, to this day, we can only rage and scream at the fact that the sponsorship process and the refugee approval process takes as long as it does, because people should not have to make choices like that. And also, we have countless situations of, as I was saying before, in terms of somebody having to live here illegally. We work with a large number of mothers who have Canadian-born children who, because they have come basically as an economic refugee, fleeing, you know, a life that is difficult, where it's not easy to make a living and it's not easy to raise your family in comfort and security. So they've come on visitors' visas and then overstayed those visas and had to live in this limbo, establishing themselves for 5, 13, 15 years. Like, we're talking really incredible amounts of time, and put in claims to Immigration Canada describing the lives that they have built here, you know, and then an officer has to decide whether or not they believe this story of, you know, a life that in Canada that's 13 years long, and in the interim are pressed with removal orders, or are pressed with a deportation, you know, looming ever faster and faster, rising ever faster and faster on the horizon, and having to prepare to make the choice whether or not to take their child with them to, most often, to somewhere that the child has is completely unfamiliar with and has never seen, has no family, no support system there, or to leave the child behind. And we're talking about kids that are like 2, 3, 4 years old. And I've worked with a couple of women who the only time that their young daughters have been forced to spend time away from their moms is when their mothers have been in immigration jail. And that's another scenario where you have to make the decision, do I take my 9-month-old, still breastfeeding child in with me into immigration jail, and I don't know when I'm going to be getting out, or, you know, on which side of the border I'll be getting out on when I do, or do I leave this child outside without me and in a situation that, you know, that's a decision that no mother should ever be forced to make. And yeah, the stories do go on, and I encourage people, if they do want to read back case victories and details of, you know, what people actually go through, to check out stuff on our website. Because, I mean, it's true that these realities are hidden oftentimes, and people don't, you know, have a clear understanding of exactly what our land of milk and honey and welcome, you know, how it actually treats newcomers.
You have been listening to CLAC Radio, produced by members of the CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence of Montreal. For more info on the squad action taking place in Ottawa right now, visit www.ottawa.indymedia.org. For information on OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, visit www.ocap.ca. CLAC's next General Assembly is July 9th at 7 p.m. at LEX, 182 St. Catherine East, Metro Barrie, UQAM. You can contact the CLAC at 514-409-2049 or by email clac@tao.ca. On the web at www.quebec2001.net. You can find out more information and details about the 2 days of action which took place in Ottawa on June 26th and 27th at www.takethecapital.net.